Hi, Julian.
Good.
Welcome.
All right. So we've only got two lectures left in 901. I'll be talking about neuroscience and human nature, but a good place to start is a little more about the simulation work. So I brought the video. I'm not going to show the rest of the slides for that. But these are synthetic character simulations. Okay. Now that means it's not like a cartoon what you see in the movies or on television. Okay. This is simulated behavior. These creatures you see have software brains. They're making choices based on their internal drives and their motivational state set by the affect system. As I was explaining at the end of the last hour, they have an affect system and they have basic drives. The drives change according to their deprivation state. They can also be changed according to stimuli they're receiving, just like in basically simulating what happens in normal animals. They don't have very much of a cognitive system. They have no association cortex. This is called Void Star. You'll see three characters sitting at a bar. There we are. Every time you run these simulations, you get different results. And you'll see the persons watching it can give input and affect the characters. It was presented at that meeting, SIGGRAPH, in 1999. That was one of the interface devices. So the person, it was inspired by Charlie Chaplin's film. And they put sensors in these little things. They were basically like, they look like bread rolls with forks stuck in them. Okay? And they can give input right into the motivation system of the character. He's now feeling it. And it makes him get up and they can make him dance. Let's say it this way. They make him want to dance. He's dancing himself. I mean, they're not like puppets. They're not directly controlling the movements. They're controlling the motivation. What this means is that their emotions can change. Their mood can change depending on what's happening. Making him dance to the music, he might become happier while he's doing it. And his happiness is signaled by expression. His internal state is signaled by emotional expression. The input is only coming into one of them, but the other one has decided to join the dance. Disturbing him, making him fall down. His mood changes and he gets so upset he walks off. They didn't tell him to walk off, he just decided to. Tell by his emotional expression, he's not happy. People really like this, especially the kids. This little girl, her mother has to drag her away. Most of the software was written by Song Yi Yoon, who was a student in Course 9. She was working with the group at the Media Lab and Bruce Blumberg's group in developing this particular simulation. Now, any of you that have further questions about the simulation work, you can ask me later, but I'm going to, for the rest of this hour and then the last lecture also, I'll be completing this. We're going to talk about human nature and higher functions. And these are the things that I'll be going over. We often talk about the human system or the nervous system. We know it's actually made up many subsystems, and the really question is, are we talking about here one cell or multiple cells? I'll be dealing with this question of unity and human nature from a neuroscience viewpoint. We'll start with the model of organisms as information processors is used. I'll use a model from cognitive psychology. I'll go over the basic questions we can ask about that. Then I will go to some split brain studies to consider the question of how is the self split in a split brain person. Remember the corpus callosum in the dissections of the sheep brain? These are people with a divided corpus callosum. Then we'll talk about whether the normal brain can be divided that way, even without brain lesions. I'll argue that it can be. Then we'll talk about manipulation of these systems artificially, stimulating them or depressing them with electrical stimulation or drugs or altered blood sugar state. What happens to self-identity when you do that? And when we get fragmentation, pathologically, in particular, like people that have abnormalities, how do you get integration? And then we'll deal with these last questions at the end. Well, here's a general model of the organism. You see it many times, the SR model. This was Ulrich Neisser's textbook figure. He shows the input results in processing, and more processing, and still more processing, until you get a response. Now, he meant by response a conscious perception. He was a cognitive psychologist. So then you can ask, well, where's consciousness? Is that what he means by response? It's actually usually just assumed by these people. In fact, most scientists assume integration and unity in the organism. They take it as a given. I will not take it as a given. Okay? In fact, I'll argue that we cannot do that. This is my expansion of the model. Multiple parallel processes. I'm omitting the vertical connections. What I'm showing here is that there's many different stimuli coming in. There's many central processors going on. There's a lot of processing, more processing, and still more processing, and also many different kinds of responses, some of which are happening simultaneously, some of which would be in conflict, so the output system has to resolve the conflict. And we've talked about that, particularly when we talked about the visual system. Neuroscientists usually use a subsystems approach. It's the modern approach. We focus on one part of it, like on the ascending pathways of a sensory system, and work out the physiological properties of sensory analysis, or we work on motor control, perhaps just to higher levels of motor control, or we work on fixed action patterns and we study the brainstem. So these processes then correspond to reflex systems that maintain the stability of the internal environment. That's something that we know is happening all the time. It's happening in me when I'm giving this lecture. It's happening in you when you're listening to this lecture. It's maintaining the stability of our internal environment, regulating our heart rate, our blood pressure, respiration, levels of electrolytes, and so forth. So that's one thing that's going on in parallel all the time. But then we have systems that maintain our stability in space. I mean, I don't fall over. I'm avoiding the chair. I'm not running into Professor Wheatley here. I'm able to do that without thinking. It just happens. I'm focusing on my lecture. Okay. It's pretty easy to comprehend the separateness of these lower functions. It doesn't surprise anybody. Okay. What about higher functions? We assume we have attention and we can focus on just one thing. So let me give you an example here, doing more than one thing at a time. Say person X is talking to person Y. X is talking about going to dinner. He listens to Y talking about problem sets. X simultaneously wonders, how long will Y keep talking because she's hungry? X is also remembering an appointment with Z. In the middle of the conversation, they start to walk. So now they're doing something else simultaneously. So you see, higher functions are happening. Also, more than one of them simultaneously. Okay, that's the point. Now, we remember when we discuss visual system, I pointed out how the neuroanatomist sees multiple parallel systems, whereas psychologists and even neurologists often consider vision to be a unitary process. But we know, for example, from lesion studies in hamsters and rats, that we have multiple visual systems and they can be dissociated. Remember, it's possible in the frog to get one system to orient the animal in one way, whereas another system orients in a different way, so you get conflicting behaviors if he has an abnormal connection. So the different visual systems don't even have to agree with each other, and yet they go on simultaneously. Remember the phenomenon of blindsight in humans with striate cortex ablations. Remember that? These people are responding to visual input. They respond to the spatial position of things, and yet they will tell you that they don't see anything. So that's why we call it blindsight, only because their verbal system that's talking to you doesn't recognize seeing anything. Now, that's a little different way of thinking about it, isn't it? Because you've always assumed unity here. You've always assumed that if he says he can't see it, well, he is a unified person, and that means he doesn't see it. But I'm saying, no, don't think like that. He is actually multiple parts, okay? One part might respond visually, we'll say that, instead of seeing. Another part may not. I've given you examples of unconscious vision and normals. Giving you an example of how when I walk around here, I avoid objects. If people running often dodge things and they're totally unaware of it, they're responding, they're aiming toward a goal, so their higher system is what they're attending to. But at the same time, there's unconscious processes keeping them from running into things and keeping their balance and so forth. So here's the questions that occur to me when we face these kinds of things, especially when we're talking about higher functions. First of all, is it conscious or not? That's one thing we can talk about, but it's very hard to deal with consciousness. But we can ask the second question. We can ask how unified are the separate systems or subsystems. All right? We can do that experimentally. Which systems of behavior control can be separated? How separable are they in pathological cases and in normal people? Are they acting in concert? Are they unified? And if they're not, what are the consequences of that? And we'll give you some examples of that. In recent times, the functional imaging methods using functional magnetic resonance imaging have become common, and we see that doing different elementary processes, we activate most different areas of the brain. For example, hearing, we activate the upper part of the temporal lobe where the auditory cortex is centered, but we also get some other areas affected. It shouldn't surprise us. These areas are connected in specific ways. Seeing a particular thing, you see the visual cortex, area 17, activated, but also areas in the pre-striate and temporal cortex, and some blood even in the prefrontal cortex. Uttering words by speaking, we get different areas. Depending on the problem you give someone, if they're thinking, they will often activate still other areas. Now, I just want to point out here something about these diagrams, because I don't want you to forget when you leave this class, that when you see functional imaging like this and someone talks about, well, this area was activated when I did this, another area was activated when the people were doing something else, remember that they're using that term activated to mean the result of a long computational process involving thresholding. Okay? So in the case of seeing here, these dark areas are not silent. Okay, they're also active. What we're taking is the areas of biggest change. Okay, and we're using a thresholding device. And if you set your computers differently, you would get somewhat different results. But if you do it right, you get pretty consistent results. Okay, so we can separate functional modules that way. What about the modules on one side of the brain compared to the other side of the brain? Let's talk about the split brain patient. And to understand the experiments on these people, you have to understand something about the visual system. And let me go over that. There are differences between cats and monkeys, humans, and in order to do the studies with the animals, you can't control their fixation as well, particularly cats. So they actually split the optic chiasm as well as the forebrain commissures so that when they present something to one eye, it goes only to one side of the forebrain. With humans, even in a normal human, you can limit input to one side just by having them fixate a point and then presenting the stimuli off to the side. So here's a picture of a cat brain, a monkey brain, and a human brain. Okay. They show here the monkey and cat with a split chiasm as well as the split corpus callosum. Here in the human, which we'll be talking about, the corpus callosum is divided, but of course the optic chiasm is not. But we know that if the person is fixating a point in the visual field, okay, we know from the anatomy, as well as from physiological studies, that everything to the right of the fixation point will go to the left side of the retina, and that will go the left side of the brain. Okay, it goes to the left side on this eye too. Okay, but it's not being stimulated. Okay, so in the left, similarly, the left to the left of the fixation point is now going to go to the right hemisphere. Okay, so that's a basic point, but we can get the same thing in animals just by splitting the chiasm. So now everything in the left half will go to the right hemisphere, just like in the human. Let me go over some of the initial discoveries with human patients, split brain surgery. I think I discussed this case, but I may have left it out this year. Remember we talked about the disconnection syndrome in the monkey, where we split the posterior part of the callosum and they suddenly had an infratemporal syndrome because they had one visual cortex ablated. So after one visual cortex was ablated, the other visual cortex was talking to both infratemporal areas. Okay? But the only way it could reach the left infratemporal area is to go across the corpus callosum. In the Geschwind and Kaplan case, they had a person who had a lesion of the left visual cortex, just like those monkeys. But in this case, it was a vascular infarct, damage to the brain due to blocked blood flow, and that damage extended to the splenium of the corpus callosum, the posterior end of the corpus callosum. Okay, now what would that do? Think about this human being with left visual cortex out and the left end of the splenium gone. What happens if you show them a word? They have to see it with the right cortex, right? The right visual cortex. Okay, now, can they speak that? Will they say the word? Well, to say it, the information has to get to the left hemisphere because speech is represented on the left in most people, and it was in this person. Okay, how is it going to get there if the splenium of the corpus callosum is divided? Well, the answer is that it doesn't. So this person, when you show them words, they can see, and they can see the word, but it doesn't get to their left hemisphere. So she couldn't speak it. And that was the first human, clear human case of disconnection syndrome involving speech. It was reported many years ago by Geshwin and Kaplan. Sperry and his students did much more work like this because they had access to patients who were having split brain surgery in order to control the spread of intractable epilepsy. People with epilepsy, when the seizures occur, the activity spreads, and over time, other areas will also become epileptogenic, and they eventually will enter status epilepticus and die, unless you have some way of slowing this down or stopping it, and you can put them on heavy anti-seizure medication, but then they can't function very well. So they found a way to prevent the spread. One of the worst type of spread was across to the other side through the corpus callosum. So surgeons began to divide the forebrain commissures, or at least the corpus callosum. Okay, and so Sperry worked with patients that had been operated like this. So they were all people that had had epilepsy. And they were on some medication to reduce the amount of seizures. They also had the corpus callosum split. Okay, so you flash stimuli like this. Just look at the one at a time here. Let's look at this one, target. You have them fixate a spot before anything appears. Only the spot is there on the screen. And then the word target is flashed on the screen when they're looking. It's flashed briefly so the eyes don't move. The result is tar goes to the right hemisphere, get goes to the left hemisphere. So what does the patient say? He says get. He only says the word that went to the left hemisphere. Okay? If he's a split brain person. Because there's no other way, because the tar here went to the other hemisphere. If you give him little pictures and you let his left hand make the choice, it'll point to the picture of the tar, the bucket of tar. Okay. Proving that both hemispheres got the information, but only one hemisphere can speak. Similarly with key ring. Okay, key goes to the right hemisphere. The left hand, controlled by the right hemisphere, will pick the key, picture of the key, not the picture of the ring. But he will say, ring. If you show them faces that have been divided down the center, so it's one face on the left and one on the right, and you flash these, they report seeing a whole face. So there are completion effects. Okay. But actually, the right hemisphere saw one face and the left hemisphere saw the other face. Problem in these things is that it's difficult to communicate with the right hemisphere. It's usually aphasic or at least mute. But that, in fact, varies a little bit. Here shows a split-brain patient being tested. They're flashing near the visual stimulus. Briefly, the word bike appears in the right hemisphere. He says, don't see anything. Okay, but then you let the left hand make a drawing, and he'll draw something that looks like a bike. Okay, so that shows the lack of unity. The two hemispheres are processing different things. They have different outputs. Let me give you a test. I don't think any of you are split brain. But on the other hand, we usually get pretty consistent results. I want you to look at these faces quickly without analyzing. I'll give you a bigger picture of it and just tell me which face looks happier. Which face looks happier? How many think the upper face looks happier? How many say the lower face looks happier? Overwhelming. Why? Because when you glance at this, you tend to look at the center mostly and see the left side here, which goes to your right hemisphere, has the smile. Okay, your right hemisphere is dominant for your sense of feeling in faces. Okay, and so you are even more overwhelmingly left dominant people for speech and right dominant for emotion than many classes. Okay, now look at the composite faces. This is based on a similar thing. You just look quickly at the upper face and look quickly at these two faces. How many think that the left face is most similar to the face on top? A few. How many? The right? Again, not quite as dominant, but most of you, again, if you look carefully here, you'll find that most of you took the face that's a composite of the what your right hemisphere saw. This is a composite of what your left hemisphere saw. Okay? So you're not split brain, but you can show clear hemispheric differences. Okay, let's talk about a case study, and make sure you stop me so the students will have time to do the evaluations. And then we'll go back to this next time, because I have a lot of pretty interesting things to talk about, but I think I will have time to finish them next time. Let's talk about Paul, a patient studied a number of years ago by Gazzaniga and Lado in New Hampshire. There was a surgeon at the hospital in the University of New Hampshire that was operating for controlled epilepsy. This particular patient gave insights into the problem of coping with disunity. Paul's right hemisphere doesn't talk, at least in the whole initial period of study, but it understood many words and it could spell using his left hand, controlled by the right hemisphere. After 26 months, it did begin to talk. Okay. But in most people now, they have even less than Paul, less speech in the left hemisphere. So here's Paul being tested, and here's one way they tested him. Okay, they flash this, and the experimenter says who, and they flash the rest of the question to the screen. So he doesn't hear. His who was heard, of course, by both hemispheres. Both ears are taking it in. It's reaching both hemispheres. But only the right hemisphere sees the RU. His left hand spells out Paul, just showing that we can communicate with his right hemisphere. We communicate with his left hemisphere by speech. The question is, are we dealing with two separate selves in this one body? We'll define self here as the ability to express a sense of identity, time, social preferences, values, moods. We know that the left hemisphere can verbalize a feeling felt in response to something shown in the right hemisphere. So we'll have to keep that in mind. But in this study, they gave a very simple little rating test using the methods I've shown you to communicate separately to the right hemisphere and to the left hemisphere. They asked him to rate dad, for example. Like very much, likes, indifferent, dislikes very much. For each of these, very simple rating scale. And they test the two hemispheres separately. And they tested him for these different things. Dope here means drugs. And Fonz was a popular singer. They asked him about God, home. Liz was his girlfriend. Mom, on that particular date, okay, the two hemispheres agreed. Noted that there's only, in most cases, the two hemispheres are very similar. They had different political views here. This is Nixon. It was interesting to me that just reading the anecdotes about this particular test, they found differences from day to day, as you might expect. As a young man, his mood is changing. One day, he was so... They couldn't do any of the usual tests because he was so upset about something. They didn't know what it was. They managed to do this test, and they found that on that day, one hemisphere liked Liz, and the other hemisphere strongly disliked her. So that kind of conflict, apparently, can help explain the disunity in moods between the two hemispheres can lead to disturbed behavior. Okay. So how are the two hemispheres normally united? Well, we know they can get different inputs. We can give, just like I gave you a test, we can. That wasn't very formal. We didn't have a tachyscope, but we still get an effect. Normally, the two hemispheres are connected. Okay. So one hemisphere can send information across the corpus callosum to the other hemisphere. After sectioning the commissures, of course, that fails. And we know from studies of people like Paul that even attitudes and feelings can become disjointed and separated. Another thing that happens in these people, and we can see how it happens in Paul, one side observes what the other does and then tries to make sense of it. So, for example, here's a test where he sees a different scene with the two hemispheres. His right hemisphere is seeing this snow scene. His left hemisphere is seeing a chicken foot. If you get the two hands to point to pictures, the left hemisphere controlling the right hand is pointing to the chicken. The right hemisphere controlling the left hand is pointing to the shovel for the snow. So, what does he say if you ask him about it? You ask him something like this. Of course, the scene goes off. He can't see anything now. You just flash that up briefly. But you ask him, well, why are your two hands pointing to different things? And he says, we need the shovel because we've got to go into the chicken coop and shovel the chicken shit. What's interesting is that he immediately confabulates. He immediately makes the story. As if he didn't have to think about it. He was doing this apparently all the time, and I suggest that we do that all the time also. Even if it means making it up. Here's another example of that. They're flashing a series of cards, and the two hemispheres are getting a story. See, you ask him what he saw. He says, Anne came into town today. Anne come into town today. But the right hemisphere is saying, Mary may visit the ship. So, look what happens here. The experimenter says, you see anything else? And he says, well, on a ship. Who? Ma. What else? To visit. What else? To see Mary Ann. Now repeat the whole story. Ma to come into town today to visit Mary Ann on the boat. So again, you see, the right hemisphere is sort of getting the information out in little bits. The left hemisphere hears it and immediately makes sense of it. That's called cross-cueing. I think it occurs in normal people. One subsystem observes behavior generated by another subsystem. This is basically James Long's theory of emotion. A feeling occurs, action occurs in response to the feeling, and then the cognitive system interprets it, gives it meaning. Social psychologists talk about reduction of cognitive dissonance. And in this theory, your system of beliefs about yourself and the world arise as a consequence of considering what you do. So you interpret it. And that we adjust beliefs in order to reduce conflicts. And I'll give you an example of that next time. It appears that the feeling of unity is an instinctive assumption that we make all the time. And I just want to point out that this lecture will be misunderstood by you. Your left hemisphere language areas is what we refer to as you. Your right hemisphere could be seeing other things. Okay, how are we doing? Okay, let me go a little bit further. I want to ask here, and we'll probably have to stop in the middle of this, I want to ask you if the normal brain can be split into separate domains even without the brain lesions. Well, it can be done experimentally. For example, in preparing for surgery, surgeons sometimes will inject sodium amytal into one carotid artery. It will rapidly reach the hemisphere on the same side long before it will affect the other side. Okay. So you can get temporary anesthesia of one hemisphere, like the left hemisphere. We can show that the right hemisphere can learn and remember something, and it may not inform the other hemisphere. You don't always get the connection. So, for example, we can anesthetize the left hemisphere and then show the other hemisphere, the right, say something like an eraser. And then, when the anesthesia wears off, you can ask him. Now you're talking to the left hemisphere. Okay? He may not remember anything that you showed. And yet, you can give tests to show that, in fact, he does remember the eraser. Okay? Or you can test the right hemisphere alone, and you will find out that it remembers. I'm going to give you examples of automatic writing that can be done in normal people. It's a kind of hypnotic-like state that some people can get into even without formal hypnosis. It's been studied by William James in his writings, and it's also in the writings of Estabrooks. Let's at least read one example, then we'll let you do your evaluations and we'll take this up next time. Here's the one from Estabrooks. He reported an experiment with a friend who was reading oil for the lamps of China while his right hand was screened from view, was engaged in automatic writing. In this state, you can get one hand. Sometimes they have the person with his head lying down on a table, and yet one hand can be active. Even though the person might say he's not even aware of it, that's why it's called automatic writing. And you can induce that state in some people who are particularly susceptible to hypnosis. Okay, so the hand was not in awareness because of hypnotic procedures. It was also anesthetic. However, when Estabrooks pricked one hand with a needle, he pricked the writing hand, it wrote a stream of profanity. This went on for 5 minutes and included an attack on the hypnotist for having pricked him. The subject continued his reading calmly without the slightest idea that his good right arm was fighting a private war. There's another example by another guy, Kaplan. He was using deeply hypnotized people. And in this case, it was similar. When the experimenter pricked the anesthetic arm several times with a hypodermic needle, the other hand wrote, "Ouch, damn it, you're hurting me." In other words, in some cases, the information can get across. In some cases, it doesn't get across at all. You can produce dissociations in people without brain lesions, and that's the point. It's been studied by Hilgard in the 1970s and 80s, who was studying hypnosis. He invented a method called automatic key pressing, much simpler than automatic writing. And he was able to create what he called a hidden observer and show that hypnosis can be interpreted as due to the establishment of separated realms of mental activity that can be just as dramatic as cases of split brain patients. Okay, so that's where we're going to talk. We'll talk a little bit about child behavior. You can read this. I just want to point out that self-contradictory words and actions show separated realms in children, but even in ourselves, we say things like this: "I couldn't help myself. That was not really me." Well, who's that and who's me and who's I and who's myself? Okay? We can be detached. We can say, "I'm not myself today," but we can also say, "It's me. I'm damned angry." We can identify with it. So the sense of detachment varies a lot. So So is the self then separable from these states of body and brain? See, that's the question. Next time we'll start out by talking about Gazzaniga's example here. It'll give you an example of how cognitive dissonance theory handles things like this. Okay. So we're going to pass out the evaluations, and you'll have the rest of the time to do that.